chanson. Écoutez, elle répétait.
Well, I love cubism. It's my favorite style. When I see a cubist painting, I just gotta smile.
Okay, good morning. We have curator and director Stephanie Snyder here on Art Focus this morning to talk to us about the exhibition by the contemporary artist Mona Hatoum.
Mona Hatoum.
Hatoum. And her exhibition is up now at the Douglas F. Cooley Memorial Art Gallery at Reed College. And Mona Hatoum has... She's a very expressive woman. We're going to discuss that as well as her art.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of a person she is very important. And what she has to say is also interesting. And Stephanie has walked through the gallery with her more than once, I think, hasn't she?
Oh, yeah. We were able to spend, she was here in Portland for 3 or 4 days. She worked intensively with students, spent time with some people in the community, and then gave a public lecture on her work. So we were fortunate to spend quite a bit of time with Mona.
Okay. Now, Stephanie, I'm going to ask you to tell us who Mona Hatoum is. And because you were able to bring her exhibition here, and that was a lot of work, you have worked oh so very hard and done a magnificent job.
Thanks.
And this has been a controversial show, has it not, in some respects?
I guess it has been in some respects. I think that Mona's work is, although some of it is very large, arguably sort of monstrous, a lot of the magic of her work is found in the details. And it's a work that requires you to come in and focus and look and listen and spend a lot of time with it. If that's, I guess not everybody is as comfortable doing that as others. So I think that's where it has been a little controversial for some people.
Okay, well, I can find controversy almost always.
Good, let's hear it. I want to hear the controversy that you found.
Well, she was part of a group called the YBA.
She's
if you want to talk about that part of her life a little bit, because she's one of the famous artists of the world.
She is. She is. She's one of the most internationally recognized and lauded artists of her generation, especially as a feminist artist, as someone who came up in the 1980s in Britain and made a very clear declaration of her desire to explore women's experiences, women's bodies, and women as political agents. The Young British Artists movement that happened in London in the 80s, a lot of the work by people like Damien Hirst or Tracy Emmons, was perhaps more sensationalistic, not as political, and although she came up at the same time, her inclusion in that category is sometimes contested. I had an interesting conversation about it with Jeff Yahn. But the point is that at that time in Britain, when a lot of people were focusing on art markets, she was sticking to her guns as a very political entity.
Okay. I think we should go into the gallery together now here.
Okay.
And because there are people out there who haven't seen this show and may be interested in, they are going to be, if they're listening at all, they're going to be interested in what we see there. And I should also say that this show will be up until the 25th of December.
Right.
You have plenty of time to get to Reed College Cooley Memorial Gallery
right. and
to see it.
Just to iterate, our hours were open Tuesday through Sunday from 12 to 5.
Yes. Okay. When you walk in the door, you can hear the tape going. You can hear the...
Right, you can hear the soundtrack of Measures of Distance.
And do you want to describe what's going on there on the tape? Because it describes the early life of...
Sure. Measures of Distance is a video piece. It's actually a compilation of still images and two audio tapes, one of a conversation between Mona and her mother, and another audio track of Mona reading letters that her mother wrote to her from Beirut to London. And on the screen, you see the still images of her mother, and they are overlaid with images of the letters in Arabic that her mother wrote to her. And they're brought together, overlapping, meandering with each other, telling a story about, a very deep story about family relationships, about the trauma of exile during
wartime. The trauma of exile.
Because Mona was stranded in London in 1975 when war broke out in Lebanon. She wasn't able to see her parents for years at a time. In fact, her mother was estranged from all four of her daughters because of the war.
Yeah.
And letters were really the only form of communication. And even then, when listening to the video, her mother tells the story of how the local post office was bombed, and she can't send her letters, but she's giving this letter to a cousin who's traveling to another part of Europe and will hopefully deliver it to Mona in London.
Okay, so the first thing you see is the magnificent sculpture.
Right, you see an enormous steel sculpture.
An enormous steel sculpture called La Grande Brise.
Right, the great cutting and crushing one.
Okay, and right away it made me laugh because I could see myself climbing on that.
Right.
And right up to the top and putting my back against the curve that's at the very top of it. It's almost like a huge animal,
yeah,
isn't it?
Well, I love the image that you just presented, which is of that object as a kind of playground structure.
Yeah.
It's a very dangerous, potentially dangerous playground structure. It's an enormous steel sculpture based on a kitchen utensil, a vegetable grinder, a mouli julienne, which is probably more common in Europe and the Middle East than it is here.
Well, everybody knows what a julienne something or other is.
Right, we know the verb. Yeah.
Sliced many times.
Right, and the sculpture is created at such a size and with a kind of industrial muscularity that proposes that our bodies are really the most logical thing that would go into it,
mm-hmm,
and be ground down and fragmented and essentially dispersed,
yeah,
across wherever we happen to be.
Well, it's a very powerful, active shape.
Yeah, it really is.
And it has many shapes inside of it, too, that appear to be able to, if you were tall enough and strong enough, you could grab it in both hands and move it.
Yeah, and Mona has a very, coming of age or being in art school in the late 70s and early 80s in London and witnessing minimalism, she has a very close relationship with the simplicity of forms and the elegance of minimalist forms. And I think you can see that in this sculpture.
Yes.
There are parts of it that read like an Anthony Caro sculpture or a Jan Arp or a Calder.
Right. Okay. At the same time, on the ground, there are some big grates of various kinds. There's cutting apparatus,
mm-hmm,
on the ground.
Right, the three blades that you would put inside of this mechanism as you were slicing something.
That's right. And I want to read here what I wrote about that, but I'm not going to.
Why not?
Well, I can't find it.
Okay.
Offhand. But it does have, you do have the feeling that it could be a grater. You could transform it into a grater.
Mm-hmm.
And the grates are on the ground, big, great dark circles,
mm-hmm,
and they all have sharp edges.
Yep.
And if you were strong enough and a giant, you could insert these and have a heck of a noise.
Right, and to me, those three graters on the grating wheels on the ground also evoke the sense of a kind of minefield or a dangerous ground that if you were to stumble, something bad might happen.
Yeah.
They're also, as you were saying, you laughed when you walked in the gallery. They're also very funny. They remind me of this kind of, crazy gargantuan Olympics gone awry where some enormous housewife, or some Gulliver-esque housewife would come in and start wheeling them around like a discus.
You could. Okay, now let's talk about some of the things on the wall. Okay. For instance, there is a heavy paper that has been waxed heavily.
Right.
And implements that cut in the female space in the kitchen.
Right, again.
Have been pressed in so you can see their forms and a very delicate outline of the forms of these three or four knives that have sharp edges and saws.
Right. It's those pieces were made a little after Le Grand Brayeux's. They came out of the same residency period that Mona had in France at an exhibition space called La Crue d'Enfer. And they're traces of a physical relationship. They're kind of I see them as a kind of midpoint between the object that she used to make the impression and then her own body in making that impression. And they evidence this very subtle but vigorous caress of her and the object through a mediary, which I find very interesting.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to say at this time, I would like to announce that there is an excellent catalog that goes with this show. It's very, very well done, and it's done by Stephanie Snyder herself, who's written a very all-inclusive kind of a story of the life and story of the art. And everyone should have one of those. It's also Olin, what's her name?
Olin, who's a writer.
Do you know her?
I got to know her by working on the catalog. She wrote a piece on Mona's work that I found very interesting, especially because it talked about the work in relationship to surrealism, and especially talked about Le Grand Brayeux's in relationship to the writing of Kafka and the story, The Penal Colony, in which a large machine is sort of put to use on the bodies of transgressors and inscribes their crime on their body while at the same time killing them. But that article was written for a magazine called Art Papers, I think in 2000, and we reprinted it in the catalog.
I see. Anyway, if you pick up a catalog when you go in, the catalog exists as a work of art itself, by itself, and it in some ways it defends the attempt or the idea of masochism. I think it explains how it's not, I think, more than anything. Would you repeat what you were telling me this morning about
talk about masochism
in connection with some of the art that's in this show?
It's such a complicated question. I mean, Mona explores...
You use Kafkaesque.
Right. Mona explores humanity and explores the world in part by exploring her own body. And she collects the products of her body, such as her hair and clippings of her nails and you know, other things that exist naturally, but take on a very different life once they are removed from our bodies. And I think because of that, she has a charged relationship to her own body and to all of our bodies that we might look at as a little masochistic, because it explores the tension that's centered around oneself. And you and I were talking earlier about masochism and art in general. And, you know, the psychological and physical price of war, of exile, and of art making are things that are so central to her work. And I think it raises the question of what kind of relationship to the self, especially when the self is posited by other countries and other people as being an other, and not necessarily a whole welcomed individual in a society. You know, what kind of tension is created between the self and the other. How can you as a person embrace yourself when other people are constantly devaluing who you are and what you do? So that's, I think for Mona, that's a central question as an artist and as a human being. Mm. And I think that does raise the specter of masochism, and it does raise the specter of sadism too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're standing in front of that enormous vegetable grinder, and you as the viewer, your body is really the one thing that fits in it that could be ground up.
Yeah.
Then I think sadism as well raises its head, so to speak.
Good. You handled that very well.
Oh, I think
it's not easy to talk about.
No, it's not. But it's great. I'd rather talk about nothing else.
Yeah. Okay. We did talk about Kafka-esque and the large grinder. The grande broyeuse is the largest thing in the room,
mm-hmm.
but there are some very small things that mm-hmm. are very important.
Mm-hmm.
How about the photographs? There are two photographs of meat hanging,
mm-hmm.
and of course that's been done before by other artists.
Mm-hmm.
Huge hunks of meat hanging outside with a man standing right next to them.
Right. It's also been the subject of painting for
yes.
many, many, many years.
Oh. Uh-huh. Think about it.
All right, I will.
Yeah. I'm not you.
The listener. Well, you're looking at me.
So. All the way up to Hood River.
I want to think about it, too. I want to think about it with the listener. How about that?
That'd be good.
Okay. The Mona's photographs are, for me, very deceptively simple because they're not byproducts of her practice. They're central to her practice. But she takes photographs as she journeys through life and as she journeys through life as an art maker. And they become reflective of her larger concerns. For instance, the photograph called Nissan, which means chicks, that shows a cardboard box full of little golden little chicks, little
yeah.
hen, chickens.
Uh-huh.
It looks, you know, It's a moment of awareness. It's a moment of attention. It's the kind of thing that you see when you're in a place where life and food and culture is very much on the street and open.
A French market.
Yeah, a French market. I used to live in Athens, Greece. When I see those photographs, I think of the Agora, where meat is still sold outside on tables with, you know, flies, you know,
yeah.
swarming all over it. It's a very different experience and sense of food and place and culture than the American or European model.
Yes. But can I describe
Please,
the
yes.
meat? One of the meats is inside like a stomach.
The one hanging in the window of the
yeah,
shop?
Yeah, what is that?
That
one?
Is a large sheep's testicle.
A sheep's testicle.
Right.
And it's quite beautiful.
It's exquisitely beautiful. And
it's a pale yellow, and it has these little red lines
yep.
that run through it. It's like a beautiful painting.
Yep. And it's, you know, it's something that Mona glimpsed while walking through by meandering and being a kind of voyeur, you know, walking through a culture. But it's a pattern, and it's a pattern of nature. Those veins are full of blood. They're full
mm-hmm.
of life. And curves and meandering lines are very important and really run through her work, like the hair etchings that are on the wall diagonally to those photographs.
Yeah, hair etchings.
She collected her hair, and through an etching process, she printed just these little, very, very subtle patterns of her hair after it had fallen onto an etching plate.
Mm-hmm.
And they read like little clouds or sort of essences or thoughts, almost a deflection of something else that had happened, a trace of something that had happened.
Like they're very
delicate. A piece of evidence, right.
And quite beautiful.
Right, and you
yeah.
see the same kind of curving line and interest in that kind of meandering pattern that you see in the photograph of the sheep's testicle.
Uh-huh.
And then I think you see it echoed in all of the roundness and the rounded curves of the vegetable slicer, too. I think for Mona, these patterns can shift scale and material and hold the same kind of tension and awareness across media which is one of the reasons why we wanted to put them together in the gallery.
You know, it's an interesting thing to me that this artist has an idea, and she can't actually move the materials around herself, but she has to make it in her mind. She probably drew it 100 times, do you think? There are no sketching. No, we don't see any sketches of Le Grand Breuse. Mm-hmm. We don't see the sketches.
Mm-hmm.
And I envision her standing by while guys put this together.
She works very closely with the people, with the artisans.
It's fabricated.
Who fabricate some of the pieces that she makes. She's an artist who makes a lot of her work herself, and she's an artist who has a lot of her work made for her, but very much with her. She based that sculpture on a vegetable slicer she found in her mother's cupboards in Beirut when she was helping her mother clean her kitchen every day.
You have to be very careful, though. That's the female space.
Yeah.
They're working.
Yep, and she took that object from that very intimate female space in the space of the relationship with her mother in the kitchen into an industrial artisanal context, and in England worked with craftspeople to make it. It's made out of mild steel, which is malleable, in which you cut and you weld together almost like fabric. It's not like a Core 10 steel sculpture by Richard Serra. It doesn't have that thickness and that rigidity, and it doesn't develop the patina that Core 10 steel does. It's very much, I think it's as close as you can get to fabric in metal. And when you look, when you get close to it and you look at the way that the joins are made and the shapes are cut, you see a tremendous amount of irregularity. You know, it's very much handcrafted, and she worked on it with them every day and then sent it back to France.
It does have the handcrafted look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, but it's not sloppy at all. It just is handcrafted. It's just has, you can see the hand in the material.
Right, and because each one was constructed and not cast, even though there are only two of those, there exist two in the world that are that size, and the other one is in a permanent collection in Europe. And then there's one that's times 24. The one in the gallery is times 17. So there's one that's even larger. So there are three of these things that exist in the world, and they were all individually made. So each one is actually unique.
Okay, now let's quickly go from Breuse to some of the other things that are in the exhibition, such as the welcome mat.
Mm-hmm.
The welcome mat has been mentioned many times. You want to describe that,
sure.
Stephanie?
It's, I would say, about 18 by 24 inches. It's the size of a standard welcome mat.
Yes, it is.
And it is made out of steel pins, stainless steel pins, that are about the size of a regular sewing pin, I would say, and they are pushed up through a thick canvas cloth, which is completely covered, so you really don't see the substrate underneath them. And in the center, there are shorter pins that, through their depression, spell out the word welcome. If you were to step on it, depending on whether you had shoes on or not, you would either damage the object or damage yourself. So there's a serious paradox here, because the word is saying welcome, but the object is essentially telling you to stay away.
Look, it's like something you might scrub the grill with.
Yeah.
And it's dangerous, but if you had bare feet, you shouldn't try to stand on
that.
Yes,
and indeed, Reed students often have bare feet, so we hope that they're paying attention.
Now, when she was walking through the gallery, what does she have to say about that?
About the welcome mat?
Yeah.
I think I'm trying to remember if she said something in particular that we haven't really touched on. Mona is so interesting when she talks about her work, because she's very, very self-reflective and very open about the meanings that she is trying to convey. And one thing that she speaks about often, which is very central to her work, is this very simple notion of paradox, that, you know, life is and experiences are never either welcoming or unwelcoming. They are usually a combination of both to varying degrees.
Okay. And now the chairs.
Right, the Sprague chairs.
Would you describe the,
sure.
the Sprague chairs? You're just doing a wonderful job with this. Just take so
Thanks.
Much description. We want people to really see
luckily
this.
Luckily, I've been working on this for 2 years, so I actually have something to say. The Sprague chairs are made from chairs that were appropriated from a factory that was sent out of business by typical globalization of labor practices. And these were chairs that were actually used by factory workers, that even some of them still have their initials on the back. And she took them and she put one on top of another and made a pair, almost like yin and yang, or like you might do at the end of the day when you're putting stacking chairs because you have to clean the floor in a cafe. Then she pierced the seats and she bound the chairs together with copper wire, and she used language to bind them. And one of the pairs reads laid off on the seat, and the other pair reads dismissed. And it's very much a commentary on labor practices and how quickly our lives change when we lose our ability to produce something, when we lose our ability to labor productively in a culture.
And they both have inscriptions on them. One says laid off.
Right, and the other one says dismissed.
It says what?
Dismissed.
Dismissed. And the chairs have been heavily used.
They've been heavily used by...
They're extremely uncomfortable.
They look uncomfortable, considering that they were chairs that people sat in while they worked.
Yeah.
But they belong to... You know, sometimes Mona will take an object like the Moulin Julienne and recreate it painstakingly. And sometimes she will appropriate objects that already exist in a kind of assisted ready-made strategy. And so with these sculptures, the objects that they began from are still the objects that you see sitting there. They haven't been recreated. Those really are the chairs that were used by the people in the factory.
Okay. Now, we have are getting very close to the end of our discussion here this morning. Stephanie Snyder has been with me this morning. And this exhibition at Reed College in the Cooley Memorial Gallery, it's sponsored by, who's the grand gentleman who sponsors this program or this exhibition?
Well, we don't really have any particular grand sponsor, but we were very fortunate to obtain loans for the exhibition from the Norton Foundation and from the McGeady Family Foundation
okay.
for the Jupiter Hotel Fair.
That's good.
Yeah.
And Stephanie, thanks so much for coming this morning.
Thanks for having me.
We could
me.
Talk all day.
We
but
could
we can't. We're out of time. And I do appreciate very much having you come this morning.
My pleasure.
And this is Julie Bernard and Art Focus.
I love Julie Bernard. I love Art Focus. Thanks for tuning in to the Thursday morning radio scene. It's 11 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Democracy Now! And Democracy Now! Has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Swahili Incorporated, specializing in contemporary and traditional African home decor and accessories, and networking with artisans in developing African nations to support economic growth and cultural exchange. Swahili Incorporated is located at 128 Northwest 12th Street between Cooch and Davis in Portland, and on the web at Swahili-imports.com. It's 11 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland.